I'll read you something a little more cheerful. But for those of you who don't know, like I said, was born in Tijuana. I was the first member of my family to graduate from college. And my father, unfortunately, is also dead, and he was killed near here in San Luis Rio Colorado, handled very badly by the police in Mexico. And that put me in a very strange state. He was killed in my senior year of college in my second semester, and I was just blown away. So I wandered around a little bit, and I did some odd jobs and artistic things, and in 1978, I met this pastor who led this missionary group working in Tijuana with the poor. I've told this story, you probably know it, but for those of you who don't, his name is Pastor Vaughn, and I've dedicated the first book about Tijuana to him, Across the Wire, and he figures largely in my second book that just came out. Vaughn is a really miraculous guy. I call him a Zen Baptist, because he's got this strange sort of Satori thing happening, you know, and he has these snaps of brilliance, and he's also quite a commando, you know. He's a crusty old man, and I love him because he doesn't seek favor from anyone. He doesn't seek petting from anyone, and he will speak his mind whether it costs him everything or not. A good example of this is a story I relate in this book. When a friend of mine was at Sunday services at the church that he works out of, which is a church called Claremont Emmanuel Baptist. And it's become a very nice sort of yuppie church where everybody dresses really nicely and sings, "Give me oil in my lamp," and then they go home. Vaughn has been in Mexico for about 33 years, 35 years, working and seeing unimaginable things. So he has very short patience with this. And he's a legend, so when he shows up, everybody is kind of in awe of the great man. Anyway, in the middle of this church service Sunday morning, they're in the middle of one of their happy songs, and Vaughn walks in, and according to the witness, walks sort of halfway down the pew and stands there, halfway down the aisle, looking at everybody, and the song sort of petered out, and they all turned to him, you know, waiting for the word, and he looked at them and he said, "Dead sheep." And then he walked out. That's my Vaughn, leaving them to wonder what he was talking about. So I started working with Vaughn, and I've told this story at least three times today, so I'm probably repeating myself too much. But being from Tijuana, I figured I knew everything about Tijuana. You know, my family's been there at least 70 years. You know, we knew it. But what you don't know is what goes on up those canyons you see, you know, where the paper shacks are, or what's going on inside the dumps, or what's going on inside the prison, or what's going on inside the orphanage. I'd never seen it. And I realized that my family had never seen it. And then everybody I knew from Tijuana had never seen it. So I started seeing things I didn't know existed. And the first night I was there, I met this little child, which I've mentioned to you, named America. America, the orphan. And she was in an orphanage one hill over from my grandma's house in Grupo Mexico, which is a colonia in Tijuana. And America was a little blonde and blue-eyed girl, looked just like an Urrea. Probably was an Urrea. Who knows, you know? And I started talking to her, and nobody in this group spoke Spanish. They spoke the kind of store-bought Spanish that people learn, you know, and it wasn't the same as neighborhood street Tijuana Spanish that she knew. So when we started to speak, we got this really warm relationship happening. And it was time to go, and she wouldn't let me go. And the children, when they don't want you to go, sit on your feet. And you get one going this way, one going that way, one going that way, one going that way. And you're stuck. And she had led this commando raid on my feet. So to get her off me, I promised I would be back the next week. I said, "Don't worry, I'll come back, just let me go." And I walked outside, and he was waiting for me. He was like Godzilla enraged. And he said, "What did you say to that child?" And I said, "Well, I told her I'd be back next week." And he said, "Don't ever lie to my children again." He said, that little girl's going to wait a week for you. And when you don't show up, she's going to wait another week for you. And when you don't show up, she's going to wait another week for you. And she's going to wait months for you. And she may wonder her whole life why you didn't care enough to come back. And I thought, oh, man. So I went back the next week. And then I went back the next week. And then I went back the next week. And then pretty soon, about 4 weeks into it, this was Monday night, he said, why don't you come on Thursday? So I went on Thursday, and then he said, well, why don't you try Saturday too? So pretty soon I was there full time, and I became his translator. So all the kind of adventures that happen in these books that I've published about the border are from that experience translating for him and sort of becoming the ear of the people and the mouth of the people. And this thing that I find myself repeating a lot is when you can speak the language, you will hear the unspeakable. Because somebody has to tell somebody. And they ended up telling me, which was a very hard thing for me to live with. And I fled finally. I couldn't take it anymore. But these books came out of it, so it was a blessing. I thought I would read you one chapter to give you an idea of what life is like and what the books are like. This is probably one of the mildest chapters in either of the two books. So I see people buying these for Christmas presents, and I think, dang. I feel really guilty, you know? In the new book, there's a whole chapter about cussing on the border, and it's quite obscene, and this mother was buying it for a 12-year-old daughter, and I was like, bad, R-rated book. So I said, just at least look at it before you give it to the kid, okay? And my favorite story is someone who bought it for her 81-year-old mother, and she said her mother went in the living room and sat down on the couch, and all she heard was, oh, dear. So... I don't know if I was ashamed or proud of that. I didn't mean to write that stuff, you know, but you have to tell the truth. Anyway, this is a chapter called The Last Soldier of Pancho Villa, and it's pretty self-explanatory. And it's about somebody I love a lot, who is still alive, even though you won't believe it when you hear how old he is. But leaving Tijuana by way of the free road to Ensenada takes you through a dusty poverty that is suggestive of ancient days. The canyons bristle with shacks and tumbled fences, while above maquiladoras crown the hills in castle-like sprawls. The serfs below await the day the complexes above them will open their doors. The hillsides seem to crumble as you watch them. Yards are dust, and on the slopes, where the soil is often shades of gray, the people have built ingenious gardens using abandoned car tires. They dig the tires into the slope, then fill them with dirt. Often whole hillsides will be made of a staggered sloping wall of tires, and in each tire a plant or two. Geraniums, nopales. You can eat the nopales, of course. Then there are yunques, which are the junkyards, abandoned discos, a Catholic orphanage. Then you come around a bend into a field of flowers. Buttercups and mustard splash yellow over the hills. It's surprising. If you're not prepared, it might startle you to pop out of the sprawl of the city so suddenly. The sea seems to rise in the distance. And the cars spread out on the road and begin to speed, clean wind tearing through the windows. There are small towns before and beyond Rosarito. Near one of them, there's a rock in the ocean that has the exact shape of a Volkswagen Beetle. It looks like it's driving to Hawaii. You'll see a bright red building on the right. This is the orphanage that has always been run by Mama and Papa Torres. I call them Mama and Papa T in the book so people won't hunt them down. But Mama had no teeth. Her nose was a mass of brown scars from years of continuous sunburn. She was always either 49 or 70. There was no way to tell. You heard her before you saw her. She was either laughing, scolding a child or a dog, or crying out in her joy that you had come to see her. Oh, oh, she'd shout, "Qué bueno!" She plowed into your ribs as you got out of your vehicle, and if you seemed at all friendly, she gave you a fierce hug. She patted you on the arms, back, sides, and chest, in the manner of poor old Mexican women. Her palm was open, her fingers stiff enough so they bent back a little bit. And her touch was so light, you hardly felt it. It was almost as though she were touching you to let herself know you were there. Then she was liable to hold her hand up next to your face and you thought you might get slapped. And she'd offer an ecstatic soliloquy that clearly included God, missionaries, and abundant blessings. You might even have gotten a tour of the compound. She was proud of her new American toilets and bathtubs, and if you took her donuts, you could expect to end up in her kitchen, watching her sop up coffee and slurp them down. Papa, however, was more reserved. He was a shadow. You'd see him in the background, his slightly palsied head nodding gently in a white hard hat. Papa, unlike Mama, was 90. In 1978, he was 90. And in 1991, he was still 90. His skin was dark brown, brown as mahogany. His mustache was white and sparse, small enough to look like a trace of milk he forgot to lick off. His brown eyes were so faded, so encircled with cataracts and clouded, they seemed almost blue. He was 5 feet tall. In his youth, Papa rode a horse. He carried a rifle. He rode hard into desert towns and saw army garrisons fall. He slept on the ground wrapped in a thin blanket. You might see him in some of those old Mexican photographs. He has gun belts crossed over his heart. Long before he became a Christian, Papa Torres was a soldier of Pancho Villa. And when any commotion happened at his orphanage, Papa retreated into his own silence. He hid in the big chicken coop under the water tower. If you followed him, you saw a pale shape standing in there. He held the chickens to his lips. He had a few favorites. He fancied some fluffy white show chicken someone gave him. "Feel this," he'd say. You'd pet the chicken. Its feathers felt like cat fur. "Soft," he'd say. His delighted laughter quiet, his voice a reed in wind. "Soft." He'd kiss the chicken on the head. Papa built the orphanage by hand. He first made it of wood, hauling limber from limber. How about limberly hauling? Limberly hauling lumber from Tijuana. At the time, the people of the small fishing village were curious, if not suspicious. Papa made a long two-story building with his dwelling at the west end, and the boys lived downstairs and the girls above, and he called it Hogar de Luz, the House of Light. When he finished building, he painted it sky blue. Then, as a service to the children of the community, he built a church next door. He and his sons labored for almost a year using cement, stucco, and wood, and it was the first Protestant church on that part of the coast. Once the church was done, Papa realized the orphanage needed modernizing, so he hauled out his ladders and hammers again and began an ambitious construction project behind the original orphanage. This one would be entirely of brick and cement with modern bathrooms and modern dorms. American work crews eagerly joined in, bringing him supplies and fresh-faced youth groups who scrambled up and down Papa's ladders, slopping cement and banging nails. On those days, he stood watching, his ever-present white hard hat bobbing slightly. He gripped either a huge white cup of coffee or a banana, and he pointed sometimes, then looked at me as if some secret had just been confirmed between us. At the end of the day, he thanked everybody, and as soon as they were on the highway back north, he climbed his ladder and undid the work they did. Often, Papa spent 2 days fixing angles and rehammering frames. "It's all right," he said. "These young people need to work. It's good for them to have work." Because of his age and his bobbing head, Americans made the mistake of thinking him simple or diminished somehow. Once, a missionary crew descended on him to repaint his orphanage. They had brought bright red paint so the orphanage would be easier to spot. Papa liked it blue. The Americans forged ahead anyway. And the leader of the group said to me, "Tell him he's a good man," then patted him on top of the head. Papa stood there, shoulders hunched, shaking a little. He then offered me the only unsolicited comment I ever heard him speak about Pancho Villa. Pancho Villa, he said, was a gentleman. At least he allowed a man self-respect. Things went on as normal in the newly red orphanage until one day we pulled into the driveway and found Mama crying and wringing her hands. We thought he had died. She ran out to us and wailed. Papa had run away from home. He had this recurring dream. If you were friends with him, he'd tell it to you. Jesus is calling me, he'd say. He heard Jesus almost every night in his dreams. No matter what he did, Jesus intruded in the dream, took him out of whatever reverie he was in, and led him back to the same insistent vision. He saw a vast, barren plain. It was stark, dead, nothing grew there. The sun was white. He could hear the empty sound of wind, and Jesus would stride toward him, and in his hand, a seed. Papa always said, "Es de este tamaño la semillita." Mucho menos. Always, "Mira, más o menos." Jesus would press the seed into Papa's hand and indicate he was to plant it where they stood. "Here my tree will grow," Jesus told him. Papa cried sometimes talking about it. He thought he was supposed to die there. He was afraid to go back to the desert, fueled by nothing more than a dream. But he was a soldier, and he had been in the desert before. He had his orders. He put it off as long as he could. He put it off until he knew his life was over. And if he was going to die out there, at least he would know he had done his work for the children. He told Mama goodbye one morning, took a small bag of things and a blanket, and walked up to the highway. The children cried, she wrung her hands and pleaded, and the last they saw of him was the white helmet through the window of the bus. 2 months passed. A stranger appeared at the Home of Light asking for Mama. Was she related to a Señor Torres? Yes, she cried. Oh, yes. Did Señor Torres wear a white helmet and was he elderly? Yes. The man sipped a cup of coffee at Mama's table. He related a story of what he had seen in the great northern deserts of Mexico, just south of here, by the way. An old man got off a bus in a hamlet where this man had a small business. The locals watched him hobble along with his bedroll and bag, and he approached a Yaqui man. They watched the stranger talk to the Yaqui man just for a few minutes, and the two of them turned and hiked out of town. Later, when the Yaqui man returned to town for supplies, he reported the old Mexicano had brought him a message from Jesus. They were busy building a new house for God on the plains. The townsfolk regularly visited the site, and Papa somehow accumulated tools, supplies, and helpers. "Tell Mama," he told this visitor, "that we are building a church. It's going well." The fellow had business in Tijuana and was so curious about this marvelous scene that he promised to drive down the coast and report to Mama. After the end of summer, we drove into the compound. Halloween was approaching soon, and the searing heat of late September had finally drifted off as though it had never happened. Mama wore a bright dress, a scarf tied over her hair. She danced around, clapping her hands like a kid. "He's back," she shouted. "He's back." We thought she meant one of us until we realized it was Papa. "Where is he?" I said. "With the chickens." I went down to the chicken house. It was dark in there. I pulled open the wire door and stepped through. The floor was 3 inches of chicken dung. "Papa," I said, "are you in here?" I went in deeper. "Papa." He had a white chicken in his hands. He held it out to me. He gestured to me with the chicken. "Feel these feathers," he said. I petted the chicken. Papa glanced at me. Looking somewhat amused, he leaned over and confided a great secret. "I lived," he said. How are we doing for time? We're all right? By God, this is going well.